Welcome back to the program. The culture wars in America have resulted in a war on women, a war on science, and a very expensive war on drugs. Many of these strains come together in the debate over cannabis. While marijuana still remains illegal under federal law, more than half of all Americans have used it. It is a cash crop generating tens of billions in untaxed revenue, and a significant number of states have supported its legalization, even in violation of federal law. It remains steeped in myth and ideology, but over and over again proves to be of help to a great many people. Our guest today, Martin Lee, takes a look at the great American pot story in his new book, Smoke Signals. Martin Lee is the author of three previous books, including Acid Dreams. It is my pleasure to welcome him here today to talk about Smoke Signals, a social history of marijuana, medical, recreational, and scientific. Martin Lee, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's good to have you. One of the things you talk about is that when marijuana sort of makes its way, cannabis makes its way here, you make the point of talking about the fact that everywhere it winds up, it kind of stays there. It takes root, if you'll pardon the pun, and doesn't go away.
It is interesting. It's an observation that I recognize, that when I trace the history of marijuana, or cannabis as it's known originally, from its origins in Central Asia, and it gets transported by men and women across Asia, into Africa, into Europe, ultimately across the ocean by the slave ships, black slaves bringing the seeds over from Africa to the Americas. Wherever it goes, cannabis was embraced by the local culture. It became a point of controversy oftentimes, but once it's in a place, it never leaves that place, and yet it goes on to another place. It keeps spreading. There's never been a culture that simply rejected cannabis out of hand. And I think it has something to do with the fact that there is some innate connection between that plant and the human brain, which actually scientists have found it, because they found receptors in the brain that respond pharmacologically to compounds in cannabis in a way that confers significant health benefits, it turns out, for people.
Right. Well, I want to talk about that. But first of all, in talking about its early history and the way it has jumped from culture to culture, that there have always been, as you say, people that have accepted it, but there's also always been seeming opposition in one form or another.
Well, oftentimes it ends up that way. The controversy, the opposition, seems that always is attached to the plant. It becomes a target for people who want to advance a particular agenda by claiming that the plant is damaging certain social groups and so forth. Because it's relatively cheap as far as an intoxicant or inebriant goes, it tended to be that the poor classes of societies, and whether it's in India or the Muslim world or even the United States initially for that matter, it's the poorer people that tend to embrace the drug. And others have then blamed the problems of the poor on the drug itself, which really is a kind of a scapegoating. And that's a fact that seems to be repeating itself throughout history. And when you look at Mexico as well, before it came to the United States, you have the poorer sections of society in Mexico in the 19th century embracing the drug initially. So there's been a class issue at play. But, as we say, wherever it goes, it never ultimately leaves.
What about the counterculture aspect of it? You talk a lot about that. You tell this story in many ways through some of the characters that have embraced it over the years, and whether it's the music world and Louis Armstrong, or whether it's the Beats in the 50s and 60s, it constantly has this kind of countercultural appeal.
Well, I think that the counterculture aspect of the cannabis story has a lot to do with the fact that it's illegal and therefore marginalized by mainstream society. So when it creeps back into mainstream society over the years, through initially through Mexican-Americans that brought it to the United States in the 1930s, then the black jazz artists, and then ultimately the beat poets, who become the transmission belt for cannabis into mainstream America. Since these groups tend to be outsiders from a mainstream perspective, it has a counterculture association from the get-go.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about how it became more mainstream in the 60s, the way the Beats really played a large role in that.
Well, the Beats emerged, the Beat poets such as Allen Ginsberg or the novelist William Burroughs, Jack Kerouac, of course. These are famous writers these days, all have since passed away. But in the 1950s, they were among the few who were really talking openly about marijuana, praising its virtues, and they popularized awareness and use of the drug through their writing. When the 1960s came around, I think it was a constellation of factors at play, but for one reason or another, millions of Americans started to smoke marijuana in the 1960s. That was an unprecedented phenomenon. And it's my sense that this happened for a reason, and I think that's really the same reason why many Americans take sleeping pills or antidepressants or mood-altering anti-anxiety drugs. These are very popular substances, big sellers for big pharma, as it were. And I think some people just prefer to reach for some cannabis rather than reaching for those pills. And I think the same impulse, whether it's conscious or not, is at play here. Cannabis seems to address the same issues that people have in terms of those sorts of what we might say, you know, mild to moderate health issues. But nonetheless, because the drug was available, relatively cheap, and prominent in the 1960s, millions of people ended up embracing it and starting to use it, and that has grown, that phenomena, until the present day.
Is it your sense that the drug might have become more mainstream had it not been co-opted by the counterculture in the 60s?
You know, it's a double-edged sword there, because on the one hand, the taboo nature of marijuana in the 60s, remember, it was illegal, and a lot of people were being arrested for it. That taboo nature, that the fact that it was against the law, in some way added to its allure, particularly for a generation that came of age in the 1960s, that was already inclined to criticize and rebel from some of the mainstream mores, as was happening in the 1960s in terms of both the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, and there was a lot happening in the 60s, and it seems like cannabis or marijuana was almost like a spice, a flavor added to those social movements that tend to enhance the rebellious aspect in a way. And others would claim, hey, people sit around and smoke marijuana and they don't do anything, you know, and it has a motivational aspect. I think maybe for people inclined in that direction, it might exaggerate those tendencies. But overall, in the 1960s, it seemed to accentuate a spirit of rebellion, because when people tried marijuana, they found, you know, it really wasn't like anything like the government was warning. The government was saying, you smoke pot, and you'll go out. Well, back in the 1930s, they're claiming that you go out and shoot your brother if you smoked a joint. You know, of course, that's ridiculous. We look back on that and laugh. But the same kind of misinformation, or I should say similar misinformation, was being promoted for many years. And people rebelled against that once they realized it wasn't like the federal officials were saying. And that became an impetus or a catalyst for revolt.
The other part of it is that they were constantly powerful forces. I mean, even to this day, powerful forces allied against it in terms of other businesses, both alcohol, tobacco, as well as you mentioned before, big pharma, all allied against it.
Yes, I think given the fact that there's ample evidence to show that when people smoke marijuana, they tend to take less pharmaceutical drugs. Apparently they need them less. And they tend to drink less alcohol. Those studies have confirmed those tendencies. But I think really in terms of the forces arrayed against marijuana legalization in our society, the principal one really is law enforcement. They have, I think, in some ways the most to lose if marijuana becomes legal, as it may well be in some states this fall. There's initiatives on the ballot in Washington and elsewhere, because law enforcement really reaps a lot of financial gain, because they're allowed to seize the property of suspects, not convicts, suspects in marijuana cases. And the police don't have to give it back, or it's very, very difficult to get this property back if you have it seized. So that money is used actually to make police budgets, to pad the budgets, and I think the law enforcement stands to lose something financially in this equation. I think ultimately, big booze, as it were, or the alcohol industry, they can coexist with cannabis. Some people will like to smoke marijuana for recreation. Others will like to drink wine or beer or whatever. I think there's ample room for a lot of people. And keep in mind, according to the government statistics, and I think they're accurate, about 1 out of 11 people who try marijuana become regular users, and they define that as people who smoke marijuana a few times a week at minimum. So there's quite a few people that don't get into marijuana in a heavy way, and some people try it and just don't like it at all. They might turn to beer or wine for relaxing. So I think the alcohol industry can coexist. Big pharma also, there'll always be a need for specialized potent medicines to cure illnesses. Marijuana could be an asset in that regard, but it probably is not the whole story in terms of all the diseases that are out there that are serious and have to be dealt with.
It does seem that the debate kind of moderated somewhat between the early 70s and really the 90s when it became something that was looked at for medical uses and the whole Prop 215 and Dennis Perone and here in San Francisco.
Yes, I think that Prop 215 was a tremendous turning point. If you step back and look at the marijuana story as a whole, as I did in Smoke Signals, there's really two key turning points. It's almost like a film script. You know, they say there should be a plot point about 30 minutes into a film where something happens and it changes the whole narrative of the story and it moves it in another direction. And similarly, something would happen maybe 30 minutes before the film ended. Well, if you look at the marijuana story, the 1960s is that first plot point. It's going along, it's illegal, and all of a sudden there's an explosion of use, and the whole story shifts. And the same with Proposition 215, excuse me, in the mid-1990s. That shifts the story once again quite dramatically. We might take it for granted in California, Proposition 215, which legalized medical marijuana in the Golden State, but it really is in some ways a very profound revolution.
Talk a little bit about the ways in which 215 got passed, because ultimately it passed by a pretty healthy margin.
It did. It passed by about 56% of the vote it won. It was a strange situation because medical marijuana was very popular in the Bay Area for many years largely because of the AIDS epidemic and the fact that AIDS sufferers found that marijuana helped them in terms of enhancing their appetite to stave off the wasting syndrome and help with nausea and so forth. So that's really where medical marijuana was discovered in a mass scale. But you had a long tradition of tolerance for marijuana use going way back to the 60s in the Bay Area. And this is really where it all started in terms of the medical marijuana explosion or the revolution, as I might call it. It's interesting, though, when you look back and see what happened with 215, you know, there was a point at which it looked like the whole thing was going to collapse before mm-hmm. the vote was actually held. There was a lot of turmoil within the organizers of the ballot measure. There was dissension, different opinions, different strategies. And somehow, by hook or crook, they managed to do it. And it's really a testament to the fact that I think people recognized in California that it just didn't make sense to jail people or criminalize people for turning to an herb that doesn't hurt in the sense of killing anyone, that's non-toxic, and that help people for very serious illnesses. It just didn't make sense to put people in jail for that, and the vote reflected that sentiment.
One of the things, and this goes to the economics of it, as you touched on before, but political issues as well, the way in which state and local government have worked with and sometimes against the feds regarding this whole issue.
Well, that's a very important part of the story, and it's really what drew me into writing the book Smoke Signals initially. So I was wondering why there were so many police operations and attacks against medical marijuana users after Proposition 215 passed in California. Why was this still going on if it was not against the law to use marijuana if you had a recommendation from a physician? And it turns out that it's kind of a mixed bag. In some places in California, law enforcement really stepped back and laid off. And in fact, several cities, around the state, passed laws that went beyond just simply medical marijuana to state that enforcement of marijuana laws for any reason would be the lowest law enforcement priority, and police respected that. Yet in other areas of the state, particularly the rural areas, the so-called Eastern District, the federal jurisdiction, the law which covers really a lot of the state, more in the rural areas, there was a lot of police opposition to 215. Some of those counties did not vote for it. They voted against it. And in those areas, the police were given free rein, basically, to do as they wish. So the attorney general, basically what happened, the decision was made, let different areas experiment with this and do as they wish. If some places wanted to ban public access to medical marijuana through dispensaries, they were allowed to do it. If other places wanted to support dispensaries and retail medical marijuana outlets, they can do that. So it was kind of a hodgepodge, somewhat chaotic, no state standards across the board. And that made for a very tumultuous history in the years following 215. And it's taken a while for the courts to sort it out. They're still sorting it out. But it's kind of like, you know, three steps forward, two and a half steps back. Incrementally, progress has been made from the perspective of the medical marijuana advocates, but there's still a lot of opposition within law enforcement. The federal government, of course, is against it, and some state and local law enforcement officials in California have collaborated with the federal efforts to crack down on medical marijuana, and that raises questions about whether, in fact, they're breaking California law by doing so.
Mm-hmm. Talk about ways in which the effort to create more medical marijuana laws and even legalize it in some places has been impacted by this kind of ad hoc way in which it's been dealt with, particularly here in California, where you have excesses and a lot of hypocrisy, as we saw in Los Angeles and are still seeing unfold in Los Angeles, versus other parts of the state that have been much more restrictive.
Well, again, it is a mixed bag, and, you know, and other states also are experimenting now with medical marijuana laws and how to implement them. It's not just California. There's been 16 other states in the District of Columbia that have passed some kinds of laws. But what's significant in California is that the language of Proposition 215 indicates that a doctor can recommend marijuana for any condition that they feel that cannabis would help. So it's pretty broad and pretty wide open. And what's really interesting, when you step back and look at the situation, you'll notice since California passed 215, that's 16 years ago, there has not been one death attributed solely to marijuana, and there's been no pattern of abusive health practices. There's been no pattern of abuse in terms of damage done that has emerged. Now, if there is this going on, we just haven't seen it yet, and that's quite striking. It's a very forgiving herb, and really when you look at a very, very safe substance, particularly compared to alcohol and other pharmaceuticals. And I think when people debate in California how they should deal with the dispensaries, whether there should be retail outlets permitted to sell medical marijuana in their communities, if we can get past the jargon, the polarized political atmosphere, and just simply look at, well, what does it do to people when they smoke marijuana? Does it help or hurt? And if it hurts, how? And if people really looked at that objectively, dispassionately, I think we can have more sensible approaches to the whole thing, and you wouldn't have these sort of ad hoc, very wide range of responses to within the state to the medical marijuana situation.
And the Los Angeles situation is instructive because there the laws were extremely liberal and at least in the view of the city, got out of hand.
Yes, in Los Angeles, it kind of went crazy in the sense of it became really like the Wild West. There was... remember, in the Bay Area, it started first, the medical marijuana movement, if you will. And there was already, 100 dispensaries or so in the Bay Area when Los Angeles, back in the mid-2000s, only had 5. Yet there was an explosion, so by the end of the 2010, there was like close to 1,000 dispensaries operating in Los Angeles. Okay, many of these were very small, they were fly-by-night, they were existing one day, not existing the next day. But the Los Angeles City Council was kind of paralyzed. You know, the idea of regulating it was rejected by those strongly opposed to marijuana in general because they felt, well, if you regulate it, then you're kind of affirming it. So as a result, the City Council was paralyzed. They were mired in this sort of reefer madness debate, and nothing got done. So you had dispensaries popping up near schools, near senior citizens' facilities, their playgrounds, and so forth. There was no regulation at all. And now the pendulum seems to have swung way back in the opposite direction. There seems to be no happy medium. The City Council of Los Angeles recently banned all dispensaries. Mm-hmm. Now, implementing that ban is one thing. I mean, trying to ban it, they could say it, but whether they can do it, whether legally this is going to work out, it remains to be seen. There's legal cases now suing the City Council and trying to overturn that decision. So we don't know how it's going to play out. I suspect, given the fact that medical marijuana is widely supported in the Los Angeles area, the polls show like 70% don't want these dispensaries banned. They want them regulated. And that's probably the route they should take, but there hasn't been a sensible approach, in part because of all the controversy around marijuana, and no one seems to be willing to just talk straight about it, look at what the science says, and there's ample science, and make sensible policies based on what we know.
I want to talk about the science because one of the things you talk about in Smoke Signals is all of the new research, with respect to neurotransmitters and the biochemical response to some of the ingredients in marijuana.
This, to me, was really an eye-opener. I knew nothing about this when I started researching smoke signals. The science really kind of hit me like a left hook or something, and it was really astonishing to learn about this. You know, one of the misperceptions is that people make claims for marijuana, pro and con, but there's just not enough science to render an honest or an accurate verdict. That is not true. There has been literally 20,000 scientific papers dealing with cannabis, dealing with the compounds in cannabis, and what they do. Most of that work has been done with preclinical approaches, meaning not on human subjects, although it's been a lot done with humans as well. But we're talking about animal studies in a petri dish or a test tube. And what scientists have found have really been really astonishing. They discovered a whole new physiological system in the body. You know, when we went to school, in high school, we would learn about we have a skeletal system, a muscular system, reproductive system, so forth and so on. Well, the whole new system has been discovered. Not that the system itself is new, but the discovery is. And it's called the endocannabinoid system. And what that is, it has to do with the receptors in our brain and body that respond pharmacologically to cannabis. And it opened up whole new vistas of understanding human biology by studying this system, because it turns out this system of receptors that cannabis activates regulates all the other physiological systems in the body. It's astonishing. And that's why cannabis, incidentally, is such a versatile medicine. It's good for so many different conditions, particularly autoimmune disorders, old age diseases. This is where cannabis can really help. The science is very profound and powerful. You know, you can go on Google and just type in the initial THC, that's the psychoactive component of marijuana, or CBD, that's a very important compound that doesn't get you high, and it's in marijuana. Type in CBD and then put in a name of a disease. See what pops up. You're going to get an astonishing amount of material.
The CBD is what really has these properties that bond to the neurotransmitters.
Well, it's interesting. CBD affects the human physiology in a number of different ways, but it doesn't bind directly to the cannabinoid receptors. THC does. Cannabinoid receptors are in the brain. They're throughout the body. But CBD affects the endocannabinoid system in a variety of other ways very profoundly. And what scientists are so excited about with respect to CBD is that its medicinal attributes are literally jaw-dropping. I mean, they have found that it protects the brain against alcohol poisoning, that it actually promotes the growth of new brain cells in an adult brain, new stem cells. This is CBD, cannabidiol. It's the non-psychoactive component of marijuana. It also prevents the onset of diabetes in mouse experiments. A whole array of other things that quite astonishing. And the interesting aspect of all this is that CBD does not make a person feel high. It's completely non-psychoactive. The most it might do in that regard make a person feel relaxed a bit, but not stoned in the way you feel when one smokes marijuana, the typical strains one gets either on the street, on the black market, or in a dispensary. So CBD has not only just tremendous medical utility, but it also could be used by the many people out there who don't like the feeling you mm-hmm. get from taking marijuana. So it's an incredibly versatile compound, and it also can be used efficiently by people who simply don't want to be associated with marijuana as we typically think about it.
And as this research has evolved, why haven't we seen Big Pharma in some ways try and latch on to this and at least mimic some of these properties in its own products?
Well, Big Pharma has developed a whole series of synthetic compounds that do mimic some of the effects of the compounds in cannabis. These synthetic compounds developed by Big Pharma are used to research the endocannabinoid system. They're used to attach to the receptors in the brain and see what they do, trace the metabolic pathways and the molecular pathways, so to speak. So Big Pharma initially was interested in developing a drug that could block the receptor in the brain that responds to marijuana, that gives people the munchies when they smoke marijuana. You know, you often get hungry. Appetite develops, and that's very good. If you've got anorexia or wasting syndrome, that has medical benefits. Well, the big pharma scientists realized, well, if you can block that receptor, develop a synthetic compound that attaches to the receptor but blocks its activity, then you'd have the perfect diet drug. And for a while, this was available. There was a drug like this called Rimonabant, not in the United States, but in several other countries around the world. But they found that when you block this receptor, you block so many important physiological processes that it became dangerous. People ended up getting depressed when they took this diet drug. There was some suicides. Some people developed symptoms of multiple sclerosis. In other words, people would get symptoms of the many things that marijuana is good as a cure for.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one approach. But Big Pharma is still interested in cannabinoids. They're interested in developing drugs that only activate the receptors in the periphery, meaning not in the brain or the central nervous system, but those in other parts of the body, because, again, that's not the part that gets you high. So if they can develop a compound that just goes to those receptors, then they might have a good healing compound without the psychoactivity and the baggage, you know, because the getting stoned part of it with marijuana is seen as an aberrant or side effect that's rejected by Big Pharma and the medical establishment. So the story is not yet fully played out with Big Pharma and the cannabinoids, as the compounds in marijuana are called. I would say every major drug company has some people who are really looking seriously at this area, but it's not so easy, it turns out, to take simply one compound or develop one compound and make it work the way that marijuana works, because marijuana is literally hundreds of compounds in it that all have medicinal attributes that work together synergistically to confer what scientists refer to as an entourage effect that affects many aspects of the body, so that ultimately the therapeutic aspects of the whole plant exceed the sum of the individual parts when they're put together. So the approach that Big Pharma pursues, its single molecule focus, isn't necessarily the best way to harness the medicinal aspects of the plant, but they're trying, and more power to them. If they can come up with drugs that help people, then I think it's great, but it's not a slam dunk.
And is all of this accentuated by new scientific techniques with respect to the growing of it and how that changes the equation?
You know, to some degree, there are ways now that you can, through experimenting with what's called tissue cultures, you don't even have to grow the plant from a seed. You can just take tissue of the plant and then grow it from there. You know, clones are made. You take a clipping or a cutting from a plant, and you can then plant that. You've got then you can get the whole plant from there. So the growing techniques, in a lot of ways, go back to the ancient techniques of farming, of separating the male from the female marijuana plants so the females don't get fertilized. That hasn't really changed so much, but there's a great deal of science looking at the genome, the plant's genes. It has been mapped, so has the human genome. So there's sophisticated research in this area trying to understand, you know, what the sequences of genes are in a particular strain of marijuana, then matching that to maybe some particular medical qualities. All this is very new and cutting edge. We're really at the beginning of this process.
And, of course, the political debate still seems bogged down in the same place it was 30, 40 years ago.
It really is amazing. You know, it's not as, caricatured as it was back in the reefer madness days. But yet some of the same themes in a slightly different version are retread over and over again. We hear over and over again, if you smoke marijuana, you're more likely to become schizophrenic. It's absolutely dead wrong. You know, when you look back and you consider the fact that schizophrenia in our society has stayed at a very stable level, there's a certain amount of people that become schizophrenic, and that's actually cross-cultural. It doesn't matter where you are, it seems to be the same amount, a little less than 1%. Now, if marijuana caused schizophrenia, starting back in the 1960s, when all of a sudden you had tens of millions of people smoking it, then you would have seen the number of schizophrenic cases skyrocketing. We don't see that. Marijuana can amplify schizophrenic tendencies if you already have them, just as it can amplify a feeling of good mood, but it doesn't cause those kind of diseases. It really is amazing how we're mired in the same kind of debate over and over again. And when you consider the fact that the federal government's position still is that marijuana is a dangerous drug with no medical value. To me, that's like saying the moon is made of green cheese, you know. So we have to deal with this over and over again. Unfortunately, you know, it does leave an impression on people, and people have some mixed up ideas about cannabis, and it's difficult to sort out the truth because of the constant government propaganda, the constant harping on these themes. It's dangerous for children, and it's dangerous for adults, and it's addictive. Again, they're saying these things over and over again. It's simply not true. That it just doesn't match with what science is saying and what the government's own commissions, when they've actually analyzed marijuana, have concluded. They've concluded it is not a gateway drug. It does not lead to the use of harder drugs. There's nothing inherent in the plant that does that. And yet we still hear these same things over and over and over again. And as a result, you know, when it comes to medical marijuana, by and large, the majority of the country favor that as an option, that people should have it as an option. Yet a significant portion of those who favor that option also feel that the plant should stay illegal. So I think it's a result of the misinformation that people are exposed to day in, day out, that you have that kind of contradictory response to the questions of legalizing for medical purposes or just simply across the board.
Martin Lee, the book is Smoke Signals, A Social History of Marijuana, Medical, Recreational, and Scientific. Martin, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you.